So I don't know if we have to worry about anyone showing up for yoga tonight, except maybe Lisa's already here. But it's good to not—it's good to not take too long with these and break them up into different parts. But I just found this one. I think we've got, having done four segments on the guru, even though we had two slides left, we'll put that one to rest. We got a lot of mileage out of that. Of course, it's the most important topic, so there's not enough that could be said about that. This is called Krishna Consciousness, the Highest Art of Living. In Bangalore, there's a famous center. And I heard they just bought, I think it's the old Shriners Auditorium in Los Angeles, a huge building down on Hoover and Adams. The Art of Living Center, run by Pandit Ravi Shankar. And from what I've heard about it, it's more like the art of breathing. It's how to breathe. Living involves a lot more facets. And so this is called the Krishna Conscious Art of Living. And I'm not sure where I came, how I came by this slideshow. It just kind of came to me through the grapevine, but we'll go through it. Everything's based on the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. How to live life as an art. You know, poets, novelists, philosophers. I'm not sure what the significance of that bottom slide is. and I don't take responsibility for the images on this slideshow. But the issue is, how can we live life as an art? Instead of just getting through it, stumbling through it, how can we make life be like a work of art? You know, with a beginning, a middle, an end, with a sort of a perfection about it. You have to go beyond the four animalistic propensities. Ahara nidra maya maituna cha shamanyam etad pashubir nadanam. Pashubir means animal. So the animals do four things. Ahara nidra maya mitun. They eat, they sleep, they fear, and they have sex life. Those are the four activities of the animals, and their 24 hours a day are taken up with these four activities. Prabhupada talks about the stringent laws of material nature. If you take birth as an animal, though you're so stringently controlled by material nature that you haven't got time to watch TV or rent a video or go out for dinner. You're just all the time, 24 hours a day, preoccupied with eating, sleeping, mating, defending. There's no latitude for doing the kinds of leisure things and self-improvement things that we human beings do. So at the same time, we also do those same things. We have those four activities in common with the animals, but they don't absorb 24 hours of our day. That's the difference. We can basically take care of our basic necessities and then have most of our life still to decide what to do with it. Prabhupada said even a farmer in India with an acre and a half of land and a cow can work about 3 months a year and then provide enough food for his whole family for the whole year. That means he's got three quarters of his time free. Ben, our woofer, who stayed with us for 10 days, built a cold frame. It's about 8 by 10. I don't know if you've seen back there. It's quite nice. And he said that one cold frame could produce enough vegetables for one person for a winter. And that's just an 8 by 10 area. So we don't have to work hard to put food on the table, to put a roof over our heads. We're working hard to put food from across the world on the table. Exotic gourmet food, rather than just getting what's locally owned, which would be relatively easy to procure. We're not working hard to get a roof over our head. We're working hard to get a 6-bedroom house roof over our head, when in fact we could be perfectly comfortable in a 1 or a 2-bedroom roof. Most of the way that people spend their time is for luxuries and not for necessities. And even though we have so many time-saving devices in the modern age, people have never had less free time. Because every time-saving device that comes up, it just opens the vista for them to get more and more baubles and bells and whistles with which to occupy their time. So they're meditating on things which are material. They're meditating and they're surrounding their lives, orienting themselves around commodities. And this is especially evident in the Christmas season. And commodities are dead. They're not alive. And so if you're meditating on things which are not alive, then you actually lose some of your vivaciousness. You lose that which makes you human being. Now, as I mentioned, you know, we don't distinguish ourselves from the animals in the matter of eating, sleeping, and mating, defending. We eat, and the animals also eat, although in a more primitive way. And this also is, incidentally, an argument in favor of the soul. If someone says, well, animals have no soul, human beings have a soul, then they would be hard-pressed to show how it is that the animals are all that different from we are. We eat, the animals eat, we sleep, the animals sleep, we mate, the animals mate, we defend, the animals defend. So where is it there that you can say the animals are missing something? We're doing those four things, they're doing those four things. Someone says, well, we're different from the animals because we can think metaphysically. And the animals can only think in terms of, you know, those four areas. They're rational, but their rationality extends only to how to eat, how to sleep, and so on and so forth. But we're metaphysical, and sometimes that's put forward as an argument to justify our eating the animals. But Prabhupada pointed out, physical means this physical phenomenal world, and metta means above. So if we're capable of metaphysical thought, that means we're capable of understanding that, in fact, there is a soul in the body of each and every animal, and that soul is dear to God. God the Father values every soul that He created, regardless of what type of a body it comes to. So the fact that man has a metaphysical sense does not lead to man's abusing or misusing or terrorizing the animal kingdom. It should lead just to the opposite conclusion, that these are younger brothers and sisters, and we should be as responsible stewards to them. And if you look at it, if you look at how animals naturally react to human beings, you'll see there's an awe. There's a worship there. There's a natural venerance. To them, we're kind of like gods. And they tend to defer to us. And imagine the hurt, the shock, the sense of betrayal when we abdicate that higher responsibility, which is naturally ours, and in fact use our higher powers and our higher intelligence to kill them. And in the modern age, we don't just kill them in the barnyard. We don't just go out and kill them as a family pet or as a family animal. We kill them impersonally. We grow them in agro-industrial complexes, and we transport them in big semi-trailers and 18-wheelers. We fatten them up in the feedlot, and then we just run them through, shocking them, and then hanging them upside down while they're still alive, and eviscerating them, and then they come out, and the bodily parts come out in the supermarket nicely, you know, nicely wrapped with plastic and a barcode. And it's all so impersonally done that it's done on a scale that farmers around the turn of the century could never have even imagined. They could never even imagine how thoroughly depersonalized the animals could be. And it all begins with the fallacious reasoning that the animals have no soul. And yet they eat, we eat, they mate, we mate, they defend, we defend. There's nothing, you can't even show how there's any difference between us and the animals. So if you have a soul, how are you different? Only in this one sense, that you can understand that the animals have a soul. The animals may not understand they have a soul, but you can understand the animals have a soul, so therefore you shouldn't terrorize them. But here's sleeping, guys sleeping with newspapers over their head, a little calf is sleeping. Here are some human beings going through the mating game, the attraction. And the animals, the lion and his female, are also getting up to something here. defending, you know, with the Nike missiles from a rocket launcher. And then here's, what are they, elephants? What are they? Bulls? Bulls? What are they? They're bulls? Okay. Oh, yeah, I see the horns. Yeah, a couple of bulls locking horns. So these are these things the animals do. They do all these things in common. So again, I'm asking the question, in the context of the art of living, what is it that's special about us? What is it special about us? In fact, the animals, they do many things better than we do. If you examine all the different species, you'll see that each species, each body which is awarded to a living being, has a special, unique characteristic. I was just putting a slide to show together on Monday, And I put in these pictures of the hummingbirds. You know, the hummingbird, his wings go like several hundreds of times per second. Several hundreds of times per second. And that allows the bird to hover in midair and just continually draw the honey or whatever nectar he's getting from the plant while he's just hovering in one spot. Bees also, they have certain snorkels or whatever whereby they can extract honey. Some animals have armor which helps them to protect themselves. They can't run very fast, they can't fly away from danger, but they have armor so that other living entities can't penetrate that armor. Others that can't run or can't fly, they don't taste very good, or they, like a skunk, you know, he puts out all this terrible pungent odor. Dolphins swim adeptly. They swim better than we do. Pigeons, you know, they can mate, they can have sex life multiple times in a day. So whatever area you care to examine, the animals do it better than we do. We don't mate as good as the pigeons. We don't swim as good as the dolphins. We don't fly as good as the hummingbirds. We don't sleep as long or as soundly as the bear. So what is it? What is it? Because every species does have something unique to it. Something unique to it. And so what is it that makes us special? The Sanskrit word is vishvesh. What is it that distinguishes the human beings from the animal species? And what is it that distinguishes us in and of ourselves, uniquely? And this is a verse here. Dharmo hi tesham adiko vishvesha dharmena hina pashubir shamana. The special property of the human beings is that they can engage in spiritual life. That means we can ask, who am I? Apart from this body, who am I? Sham, our lama that we've had for 24 years, we got him when he was 6 months old. Real character, real free spirit, you know. I can remember in the middle of the Payson parade, the Payson Onion Day parade one day, Sham was in the parade, and the announcer was saying, here come the llamas, you know, aren't they great? Llamas are such great animals. They do whatever you want them to do. And at that moment, Sham decided to lie down right in the middle of the parade route. And the announcer was really good. He was really quick on his feet. Without missing a beat, he said, except when they don't want to do what you want them to do. So Sham afforded everybody along the parade route a good laugh on that day. And even though he lay down on that occasion, on another occasion, Adidas Shoes rented four llamas from us to shoot a commercial for ESPN. And in fact, the commercial did run for about 6 months on ESPN. And it was shot up in Lehigh, and so I took four animals, four of the best animals, and I thought Sham was the least, you know, likely one to come through for me. And I took three really good animals, and then I took Sham. But when it came for the main shot, they want an animal to run about 100 yards down the road and turn right. And they had to do that shot three or four times until they got all the angles they wanted. And Sham was the only llama that would do that, and he did it three or four times. And he did it to perfection. And then even 2 years, when he was 22 years old, which is quite old for a llama, he won the llama race in our llama fest. He just decided he was just going to, you know, kick all the other llamas' butts on that day. And he did it. You know, he won by about four lengths. You know, he beat all the, you know, the 5- and 10-year-old llamas. So anyway, he's come to the end of his life, and he's been lying out there for almost 14 days. He hasn't been able to get up. And he's just amazing us. He's just amazing us that he's lingering that long, and he actually looks peaceful, and he was eating hay today. My gosh, what's that all about after 14 days, you know? But he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand the difference between the soul and the body. He doesn't understand exactly what's happening to him. He doesn't understand that his soul is going to separate from his body any moment now. And what he does, he lies there, and he just thinks about eating grass with the other llamas. That's his standard of normalcy. That's his standard of happiness, is having food, sustaining one food. So you'll notice every once in a while his legs will kick. His legs will sort of spaz, you might say. And what he's trying to do what he's done thousands of times before, is just get up and be with the other llamas. He doesn't understand that this is it. A human being would understand. A human being would understand. A human being would understand. I'm not getting up again. It's all over. You know, I'm not going back to that. From books, from introspection, from discussion, a human being would understand. It's over. Now I've got to look to beyond this life. But the Lama doesn't understand. He doesn't actually know what's happening to him. And he thinks that by kicking, all of a sudden, the last 14 days and the sickness which has preceded that will all somehow other be negated. And he'll be up and he'll be young again and he'll be back eating grass with the Lamas. And that's what that kicking is all about. There's no reason for his kicking except he's just you know, thinking that this is all a bad dream, and one of the times I'll kick and I'll find myself on my feet and I'll be with the other Lama. He doesn't understand about death. He doesn't understand about the soul. And he doesn't understand what lies ahead of him. What we do so clearly. And that's what distinguishes us from the animals. That metaphysical sense of understanding, or at least seeking to understand, who am I? Where have I come from? Where am I going? What is the purpose of life? So until one understands that, one cannot make of one's life an art. Otherwise, life is just maintenance, eating, sleeping, mating, defending. There was a philosopher many, many thousands of years ago. In our culture, we call it Epicurean. An Epicurean, someone who lives for the moment, a hedonist, someone who believes in the eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die. I don't think Epicurus was actually so shallow. I think Epicurus was actually quite an insightful philosopher, but somehow he's gotten this bad rap, you know, that when you talk about, when you describe someone as an Epicurean, you're basically describing a shallow person. I think poor Epicurus would be rolling his grave right now because he actually wrote some very good philosophy. But his predecessor in India for many thousands of years was a man named Charvak Muni. And the just like I was speaking on Sunday at the Sunday feast lecture about the ghee belly, you see, the standard of enjoyment traditionally in India was, if you go back to the 1950s or the 1900s or 1850s, that the standard of enjoyment was if you could eat ghee. That was the best way that you could enjoy your prosperity and show others that you are prosperous is just to cultivate that little ghee belly. So, you know, if an Epicurean in our modern age is someone who eats, drinks, and is married for tomorrow we die, a follower of Charvak Muni in that culture of India would be one who would beg, borrow, steal, whatever you have to do, eat ghee in this life because tomorrow you die. That's how that translates, you know. Charvak Muni said, whatever you have to do, beg, borrow, steal, eat ghee, because you only live once, and if you want to enjoy life, you want to make the most of life, get as much ghee as you can, and die with a nice, you know, good little ghee belly there. That's the best you can do. These are different reactions. Whole schools of philosophy have evolved, sprouted from the issue of sense gratification and hedonism. Those who try to enjoy this material world and they fail because we're made for so much more. We're made for self-realization. We're made for immortality. And no wonder when a living being who has a human body tries just to do nothing more than beg, borrow, steal, eat ghee, eat, drink, and be merry during their life. The tragedy is that they're wasting their life. They're not fulfilling their potential. And so there's an inevitable disappointment there. And being disappointed with trying to squeeze satisfaction out of the material world, then one sometimes exhibits the sour grape syndrome. The fox was trying to jump up and get the succulent grapes, but he found he couldn't jump high enough. And so then he rationalized it by, as he walked away, said the grapes are probably sour anyway. So there are different philosophers who have tried, so-called quasi-pseudo-philosophers, who have tried for enjoying this material world, and they've been unable to get satisfaction from it. And so therefore they declare it as false. These are the Mayavadis. The Mayavadis say, Brahma Satya Jagat Mitya. Spirit is true. Brahma means spirit. Satya means truth. Jagat refers to this phenomenal world, and Mitya means false. So they say, Brahma Satya Jagat Mitya. Spirit is true, this material world is false. And then there's the Sunyavadis, who are the Buddhists, and they just make everything zero. They just make everything zero. It's not, because it's temporary, it's not even real. It's not even real. A Sunyavadi would take a pot and he would say, this is not a pot. This is not a pot. This is clay. It was clay in the past. It will be clay in the future. So the idea of describing or visualizing this as a pot is an illusion. Just call it clay. But our philosophy is, okay, it's temporary. It's temporary. That's true. And it does come from clay and it'll go back to clay. But in the meantime, you know, you can have a nice bowl of soup with it. You know, you can drink some grape juice. You can do a lot of things with the pot. It has its purpose, although it's temporary. So as devotees of the Lord, we believe that this world has a purpose, that this body has a purpose, and that we're put here to fulfill a purpose. Missing that, one can become a monist, a Mayavadi, who says everything is illusory, or a Sunyavadi, which says everything is zero. When we bow down and offer obeisances to our guru, we say, Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutare Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine. Offer my respectful obeisances unto our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paskita Desatarine. Paschim is a Sanskrit word which means west. And Deshatari are the western countries. And it was traditionally believed in India that the west, the further you go west, the more degraded things are. The more degraded, and that actually is not, didn't used to be very far from the mark. And if a Brahmin left India and went to the western countries, then when he came back to India, they wouldn't let him be a Brahmin anymore because they figure he'd associate with all kinds of meat eaters and low-class people, and now he's no longer a Brahmin. In fact, even a couple of years ago in Udupi, which is where our Nikunj was born, every 2 years, there are eight moths, eight branches that Madhvacharya established of Krishna devotees in the 12th century. And the main Udupi temple sits on the square, and then there are eight other temples that go around the square. So every 2 years, whoever's the head of the temple, he comes in and he does the personal worship, the Mangal Arati, the bathing ceremony for the deity. And every 2 years, that switches and it goes from one mat to another. So in the course of 16 years, every one of those eight mats will have been able to send their head into the main temple to do personal service for the deities. And during those 2 years, he's like the head of the whole order. But then he's replaced by someone else a couple years later. So the man that was, so he's out now, but he was supposed to go, he came in 3 years ago, and he'd been to the West. He'd been to the West, and the leaders of the other seven Mats temples, they walked in the streets, they held up signs, and they didn't want him to take his turn serving the deity, because he'd been to the West. And they tried to intimidate him and browbeat him, and try to talk him down from taking his turn because they thought he was unqualified by virtue of having gone to the West. Fortunately, this is a guy with a little bit of spunk, and he said, I didn't go to the West to take the association. We all agree they're degraded, they're fallen, they're uncivilized. That's not a point of contention. The point is, I did not go to associate with them. I went to preach. And indeed, wherever he went, he gave lectures, and he was trying to acquaint them with the culture of India. So he said, I didn't become adversely or negatively affected by it, but many people became positively affected by my touring the Western countries, just like Prabhupada did on a much grander scale. So fortunately, he stuck to his guns, and then in spite of protests and controversy, he went and he was appointed, and he did his 2 years, and now it's the mantle is passed to another one. So it says, Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paskita Desatarine. It says that Prabhupada came to kick out Nirvishesha Sunyavadi, voidism and impersonalism from the Western countries. He came to kick it out. Even Christianity. I've heard many Christian preachers say God is invisible. You can't even see Him, so how can you serve Him? That's impersonalism. I mean, you may believe in a personal God, but what good does it do if you cannot serve Him in a personal way? It becomes impersonalism by default, you might say. When Jesus Christ says, love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, that's personal. That's personal. And Jesus doesn't say, love me with all your heart and all your soul, all your mind. Of course, we love Jesus because He's our, via media, He's the Savior. But he didn't say, love me. He didn't say, I'm God, love me. He said, love God. So that's someone other than Him. That's His Father. And so if we don't have any information about that person who sent Jesus, then how are we going to love Him, you know? It becomes religion instead of relationship. So Prabhupada came to establish a specific idea of God, to give detailed information. Prabhupada used to say, we know, you can ask us. You ask us in a non-sectarian mood. This isn't about conversion or denominationalism. Prabhupada said, if you're Catholic or if you're Mormon or if you're Jewish or if you're Muslim and you want to know more about God so you can love Him better, ask us. Ask us. We've got the information. We're a resource. Use us. You know? And what sincere follower of a religious path would pass up an offer like that? I mean, after all, if you don't like what you hear, you don't have to accept it. If it doesn't give you a better idea of God than what you've got, you're under no obligation to accept it. But the fact is, it does give complete information about God, detailed information. His name, His address, where He lives, who His friends are. Prabhupada said, we even have His phone number. We even have His phone number. You know, there's that joke that was going around for a while. In the Vatican, there was a red phone, and it said, hotline to God. Did you see that? It's going around about it. It said, hotline to God. Pay $500, you get to pick up the phone, you get to talk to God for a minute, you know. And then in Jerusalem, you know, they had a phone, and it's a hotline to God, and it's $250, you know, and you pick up the phone, you get to talk to God for a minute, right? In Benares, you know, the holy city of India, they have a red phone, a hotline, you know, it costs about 35 cents, you know. And so someone said, well, it's $500 in Italy, it's $250 in Jerusalem, how come it's only like 35 cents? They said, because it's a local call. So Prabhupada, he made God local, you know. We can't expand or extend ourselves high enough or far enough or wide enough to see God. You know, we don't have that capacity. You can't put an elephant on a little teacup. But the point is that Prabhupada brought God in the form of the deity and in the form of the Krishna book and in the form of the Srimad Bhagavatam and in the form of the Bhagavad Gita and in the form of the Disciplic Session and in the form of Prasadam and in the form of Kirtan and in the form of festivals. He brought God home. He brought God to the Western country. He didn't bring another religion. He didn't bring another sect. He didn't bring another denomination. He brought God. In the early days, he was giving a talk at Berkeley, University of California, and someone challenged him. Swamiji, there are so many religions, so many sects, so many denominations. Why have you come to America? And Prabhupada said, I've come to teach what you have forgotten. I've come to teach love of God. I've come to teach love of God. And that's the purpose, you know. So many preachers, so many communications, so many religious leaders, they say, it's not about religion, it's about a relationship. But the problem is you need more information than what's presently available in Judeo-Christian tradition in order to know who God is so that you can love Him. For us, you know, they say to know one is to love one. That's not always true in our case, you know. It's not always true in our case. Sometimes you see older couples and they're just like, you know, they can't even say a civil word to each other. And it's just gotten worse and worse and worse over the years. So in those cases, I don't think to know one is to love one. It's just the opposite, you know. But because God is the most wealthy, the most handsome, the most beautiful, the most strong, the most knowledgeable, the most humble, indeed, never was this aphorism more true than when it's applied to the Supreme Personality of God. To know Him is to love Him. And so Prabhupada said, in a non-sectarian, a non-denominational spirit, we happen to be the heirs to the most complete, comprehensive body of knowledge about God that's available to humankind. So please, if you're sincere, avail yourself of it. We're here only to enrich your experience, to enhance your knowledge, and not to convert you. We're not here as a threat. But if you'll take advantage of this knowledge, which is supplementary and complementary to your own scriptures, you'll become a better Mormon, better Christian, better... Actually, no, you won't become a better Mormon, better Christian. You'll become a better lover of God. Why do I keep saying you'll become a better Mormon, better Christian? We don't want people to be better Mormons and better Christians. We want them to be lovers of God. And that's what Jesus wanted. That's what Muhammad wanted. Jesus didn't want to make Christians. Muhammad didn't want to make Muslims. They wanted to spark love of God in the hearts of the living beings. And each and every one of them gave some insight, some vision. They added to the knowledge, the collective human knowledge of what God is. But nobody gave more, and more completely, and more antiquely, and more primevally than Vyasadeva, who wrote the Vedic literatures, the mature fruit of which is the Srimad Bhagavatam. And no manifestation of God was more complete and more full than that of Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who came here personally 5,300 years ago, and he was on the planet for 125 years. We'll stop there.